Okay, I guess we'll get started. So it's a great pleasure for me to introduce our next invited speaker, Dr. Daniel Carlson. For those who don't know Dr. Carlson, he got his PhD from Temple University, followed by a postdoc at Johns Hopkins, then took up his first position at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in the Biochemistry and Molecular Biology Department. He was actually there for 15 years before being recruited at the University of Delaware, where he was chair of the Biological Sciences Department. And recently, in 2009, he's been recruited by Rice University, where he currently is the dean of the Weiss School of Natural Sciences. And Dr. Carlson, as you'll see from his talk, has made very important contributions to the field of embryo implantation. So we're all really anxious to see what he's going to talk to us about today.
Thank you, Dan. First of all, I want to thank all of the organizers for the invitation to come to this really beautiful campus and city and participate in what's been an absolutely terrific program. I also am impressed by the endurance of this crowd to have lasted this long. You still, most of you have your eyes open. I emphasize most.
Wake up!
I'm particularly impressed by the students and fellows. I think you did a great job in your presentation, so I want to thank that again. Nice job. And finally, I have to compliment Dr. Bernard for being one of the most persistent questioners I have ever seen. All right. I got in the field of reproductive biology in a weird way. I'm really trained as a glycoprotein biochemist, and I became fascinated with the idea of how cell surface molecules and molecules of the extracellular matrix that were variously decorated with carbohydrates would participate in the embryo implantation process. And to show you how narrowly I look at embryo implantation, when I say that, all I think about is how the embryo initially attaches to the uterine wall, how it attaches to the apical surface of the uterine epithelium, just that initial event. And so that's what we tried to focus on over the years to try and understand. The approach was really to try and understand what the molecules were that mediated that initial attachment, with the idea that if we could understand the molecules that were normally involved, we might get some insight into things that go wrong and infertility and so on. And so over the years, my lab and other labs worked on identifying some of these molecules. We identified some proteins that were on the surface of the blastocyst of various sorts, some of which were fairly normal-looking proteins, and some of them are very large, ugly-looking proteoglycans that are variously glycosylated and difficult to work with. And so I was very eager to start working on molecules on the surface of the uterine epithelium, and with the hope that they would all be fairly normal-looking proteins, receptors, and things that run well in gels and would be just a lot more fun for me to work on and less frustrating for graduate students and fellows. We wound up finding this thing, which looks like a centipede here, which is called MUC1, and it's actually a very big and ugly glycoprotein, and so my best hopes were immediately dashed, as are most of my hypotheses as time goes on. One of the ways that we discovered this glycoprotein, we were trying to take an unbiased approach to understand what the molecules were in the apical surface of the uterine epithelium. And so we developed procedures along with Stan Glasser at Baylor College of Medicine to isolate uterine epithelial cells and culture them under polarizing conditions, and we used various vectorial labeling procedures to understand what the molecules were that were displayed on the apical surfaces of these epithelial cells, figuring that the embryo receptors had to be among these molecules. And that red circle up there is just going to typify the whole thing. So those are the kinds of things we found. I mean, so you're going to say this is the ugliest gel in the world. This is actually pretty good for these molecules. So this was actually discovered by a postdoc in the lab, Maria Valdezan, and this is some work from Ruth Pimentel, who was a master's student in the lab, just characterizing these things. And she immunoprecipitated these high molecular weight, heavily glycosylated molecules, and found out that among them is this thing called MUC1. MUC1 is a very large mucin-type glycoprotein that dominates the... Okay, good enough. How many years of experience do I need to figure out how to push a button on a light? So MUC1 is a very large, heavily glycosylated glycoprotein. It actually sits on the apical surface of most mucosa throughout the body, and I'll talk about this tissue distribution in a minute. And these transmembrane mucins, as well as the secreted forms of mucins, really dominate the surfaces of mucosa. They are huge, and there's usually a lot of them. So to give you an idea of the size, so it's a type 1 transmembrane glycoprotein, a single transmembrane spanning region. If the plasma membrane is here, a typical cell surface receptor like a growth factor receptor, an integrin, even a syndican, would extend from the surface about 30 to 50 nanometers. The mucins are rich in tandem repeats of about 20 to 21 residues. They're rich in serine, threonine, and proline residues and very heavily glycosylated. So they have very highly extended structures, and they suck up a lot of water, so they're physically very big. So they extend hundreds of nanometers from the cell surface. So this is a transmission EM of the microvilli at the apical surface of uterine epithelia, and you can see all this fuzzy stuff sticking on the sides. This is a scanning EM. These are both done by Chris Murphy, and you can see all this fuzzy stuff. Those are the mucin glycoproteins, so they're huge. And these are dehydrated. When they're hydrated, they take up a lot more space. Just another cartoon of this. It's the epithelial expression throughout the female reproductive tract, the male reproductive tract as well, different sorts of mucins in the digestive tract, lung, kidney. There are low levels in certain cells of the immune system, but they're predominantly in epithelial cells and always in normal cells restricted to the apical cell surface. And the reason for that is a large constitutive function of mucin glycoproteins is to provide a barrier. They're very anti-adhesive generally. They're very hard to, very resistant to enzymatic attack. So mucin glycoproteins are one of the reasons that your stomach doesn't digest itself. They're anti-adhesive nature. The heavy glycosylation makes them hydrate a lot and lubricate the apical surfaces of cells. It's why your tongue doesn't stick to the side of your mouth unless it gets dry, and then the mucins dry out. So it has these constitutive functions, which are all attributed to this large ectodomain. It's anti-adhesive, so the receptors that let cells bind together are much smaller than these transmembrane mucins, much smaller than MUC1. So when this is dominant over the surface, there's no physical access to those receptors. Proteins can sort of filter through these mucin barriers, but not whole cell surfaces. And if you force expression of mucins on non-polarized cells, it inhibits both cell-cell and cell extracellular matrix adhesion. So that's been shown by many labs. It also protects cells and inhibits killing of target cells by the host immune system, and I'll revisit that a little bit later. Oddly enough, the ectodomains do get shed from these cells, and they serve as markers of various disease states like cancer and endometriosis in some cases. It's among other diseases. But they actually have an immunosuppressive function, which we don't understand. There's a couple of papers in very good journals by different labs that report this, but we haven't figured out why that is. Cells that express a lot of mucins, many chemotherapeutic drugs, and I don't need to tell this audience, are very hydrophobic in nature, and it's very difficult for those compounds to get through this very hydrophilic layer, and that's going to be more important when we talk about some things later on. The real surprise, I think, to many people in this field, this cytoplasmic tail is more than 95% conserved at the amino acid level among species, including tyrosine residues and various sequences that bind different proteins like beta-catenin and several others. And it participates in a number of signal transduction, intracellular signal transduction events, including protecting cells from apoptosis. That may be more important in terms of certain disease states than normal physiology, but we don't know that yet. So what's the story in MUC1? Just a statement, and I'll just focus your attention to this, these panels right here, which are wild-type mice on day one after mating and day 4.5, which in this strain would be when implantation occurs. This red staining here is for MUC1. Ignore this, but this is really the important panel here. This staining here for MUC1 is completely, it's greater than 95% loss. MUC1 is lost at that level, at the RNA and protein level, on the day of implantation. And difference, and so I'll make a general statement. We've looked at that and looked at this in many species from monkeys, baboons, domestic species, rabbits, rodents, there's probably more on the list. But the general observation is that MUC1 is lost at implantation sites. Now, in certain species, that's controlled. The loss of MUC1 is controlled by steroid hormones, notably progesterone, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. In other cases, it's lost locally, just at implantation sites. That we were able to show that in rabbits, where we could actually look at a real implantation site and show that it's lost there. And experiments that were done by a group in Europe took human blastocysts and put them on human uterine epithelial cells in vitro and showed at the site of embryo attachment in vitro MUC1 was lost as well. So it seems to be a general principle. So how do you lose MUC1 locally? Amantha Thathia, when she was in the lab, was able to identify two cell surface proteases that mediate MUC1 shedding and release from the surface. So there's a mechanism for that. How does proteases get activated by the blastocyst, we don't know yet. But there's a hormonal mechanism in many species that just downregulates MUC1 throughout the luminal epithelium, and then there's this localized shedding that occurs in some species, and that may relate to some of the characteristics of mating. So this is the sort of the general model that's evolved for MUC1, is that following fertilization, the embryo develops to the blastocyst, hatches out of the zona pellucida, and actually shortly after it hatches out of the zona pellucida becomes attachment competent. So the uterus in a non-receptive state or a pre-receptive state, even if the embryo, an attachment competent embryo is transferred in at that time, cannot attach. And the mucin barrier is one of the problem. In parallel with development of the embryo to the attachment competent state, the uterus is developing as well to a receptive state. And the concept that's emerged is that what accompanies that is loss of MUC1, and that loss is either accomplished by downregulation, downregulating expression of the gene and more globally losing it, or locally stimulating shedding and clearing sort of a landing pad. So I think the concept to take away here is loss of MUC1 is necessary but not sufficient for an embryo to attach and implant. It's a barrier. So you still need to have adhesion molecules, and things like alpha V, beta 3 integrins and other candidates have emerged in studies over the years that can do that. But if MUC1 is present, there is no access to those receptors, and implantation can occur. So some experiments that we did that support this notion is in all species that we've tested, MUC1 gets lost during the receptive phase. You can drive up MUC1 with antiprogestins in rodents or by treating with high doses of estrogen, and that inhibits implantation as well. It turns out the polarized mouse uterine epithelia constitutively express very high levels of MUC1, and they're functionally non-receptive in vitro. If you there is one enzyme that actually is capable, partially capable of digesting mucins, cleverly called mucinase. You can tell a biochemist came up with that. If it was a Drosophila person, it would have been a much more clever name. IFAN would tell you, right? So if you remove these mucins, it will convert these polarized cells to a functionally receptive state. If you use polarized uterine epithelia MUC1 knockout mice, they're functionally receptive as well. Blastocysts will normally attach and invade most cell lines in culture. They have no problem with doing that. But if you force expression of MUC1 on those cells, then embryos have a very difficult time attaching and spreading on them. So you can both take away MUC1 and make them receptive, and you can force MUC1 expression on cells and make them non-receptive. So in different species, different strategies. So in terms of hormonal controls in rodents, estrogen stimulates MUC1 expression, progesterone inhibits it. MUC1 is lost throughout the luminal epithelia and embryos can attach. In rabbits, it's more localized. Progesterone actually stimulates MUC1 expression in rabbits, but it's locally lost at the implantation site. So in humans, we can't really do the implantation experiment, but it was John Aplin's lab observed that during the progesterone-dominated phase of the cycle, MUC1 mRNA levels are actually higher than that. So MUC1 is actually high. Like I said, in vitro, it seems that human blastocysts can cause a local clearing of MUC1. But we were puzzled by why progesterone should downregulate MUC1 expression in rodents and upregulate it in other species like rabbits and humans. And it turns out that progesterone receptor isoforms differentially regulate this, and that seems to be the explanation. So here's some experiments that Melissa Brayman did when she was a graduate student in the lab to show that this is just looking at promoter activity of the MUC1 promoter. And so if you just give them purely progesterone receptor B, progesterone gives a nice response. But if you start dosing in progesterone receptor A, it squelches the progesterone receptor B response. In this series of studies that Melissa Brayman did, along with Orla Keneally and colleagues at Baylor College of Medicine, we took advantage of the availability of various types of progesterone receptor knockout mice. And so they had mice that had both forms of the progesterone receptor knocked out, the PERCOs, the ACOs that only have the A form, or the BCOs that only have the B form knocked out. And the bottom line here, and maybe the RNA will tell the story, is that if you knock out the progesterone receptor type B only, it phenocopies the wild type. So the progesterone receptor A, you don't need the B to get the normal pattern of expression of MUC1 in response to steroid hormones. And so it turns out the progesterone receptor type A is the dominant form of progesterone receptor in the mouse uterus, and so that fits. And in humans, there's the progesterone B-A ratio changes, and B is a predominant form, but it does change during the cycle. And so the interplay between progesterone receptors A and B and the antagonism of the two seems to be involved in differential responses to progesterone, at least among these two species. Other things happen to human MUC1 during the cycle. I promise not to get too much into carbohydrate chemistry, but MUC1 actually gets decorated with different types of carbohydrates. During the mid-luteal or receptive phase, it gains these much larger oligosaccharides called keratin sulfate that generally are kind of anti-adhesive and related to some structures called lactose aminoglycans that we studied some years before. So it gets decorated differently. We don't know what the function of that is. This is also some work, and this is just using antibodies to MUC1 or various antibodies that recognize selectin ligands, taking extracts from looking at MUC1 in the human uterus throughout the cycle. And so selectin ligands are carbohydrates that are recognized by a class of proteins called selectins that mediate cell adhesion under certain circumstances. Susan Fisher's lab showed that human blastocysts actually shed pieces of selectins, and so the idea emerged that maybe human blastocysts could bind to selectin ligands on the uterus and help mediate the initial tethering to the uterine wall. And it looks like MUC1 can actually carry these selectin ligands. And so it's possible that in the human, MUC1 may actually place a bit of a role in initially tethering the embryo to the cell surface. I won't go into much more about that. We wondered about other factors that might regulate MUC1 expression, and there was a list from a review of the literature indicated a number of factors that were commonly observed to increase in at least a few species during the peri-implantation period. And so we surveyed these things to see if they would stimulate MUC1 expression in models that we had available. And these are just some promoter assays looking at promoter activities. It turns out another general principle is pro-inflammatory cytokines really stimulate MUC1 expression. And they actually synergize. This isn't the best data for synergy here, but Neerja Dharmaraj, when she was a graduate student in the lab, really showed that elegantly that very low concentrations of pro-inflammatory cytokines that by themselves do very little to MUC1 expression can synergize and give you a very robust expression. So a general principle that we think this indicates we think this makes sense because at the site of an inflammatory reaction in a mucosa, one of the quick ways that you can mount a defense or is to put a physical barrier up at the site of injury. Mucins are very large, very effective barriers. And we've looked at this in many different cell types, both primaries and cell lines, and if cells are capable of expressing MUC1, they will respond robustly at both the RNA promoter and protein level in terms of being stimulated by these cytokines. And the fact that the cytokines can synergize creates an opportunity that even though the cytokines may diffuse away from a site of injury, since they can synergize, they can still mount responses at we think, distant sites. At one point in these studies, when we had finished looking at some of the functional stuff, we were sort of looking for something else to do. So we did what any other desperate scientist would do in our position, which was we bashed the promoter. So we did this, and we figured out where the progesterone responsive elements were and where the cytokine responsive elements were. And there was around the time that we were finishing up part of these studies, there was a paper that appeared in mice saying that a transcription factor called a peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma stimulated MUC1 expression in mice. And we thought, well, we're studying the human promoter. Let's just verify that this happens there. So, of course, it did exactly the opposite. It actually represses it completely. That's a good thing, because one of the things that we would have liked to do, I really fully expected it to stimulate, and we showed, in our hands, we showed it does stimulate the mouse promoter. It turns out there's a 20 base pair deletion in that region of the human promoter that seems to be the difference between the mouse and the human, and that changes the regulation here. Well, one of the things we had always hoped that we could come up with is a drug that we could use to lower MUC1 expression, because maybe in infertility, if these mucins are a barrier, if we could drug it and lower it, maybe you could improve implantation success. It also might be handy in cancer, because many cancers highly overexpress MUC1. In fact, it was discovered by people studying cancer and is used as a tumor marker. Reducing MUC1 wouldn't kill a tumor cell, but it might make it easier to be killed by something else. Like I said, the host immune system or by these drugs that you can add. So I've talked about it. Neerja and others and Aaron Legow and Peng Wang worked on this and really developed an idea that's probably still just very partial of what the MUC1 promoter looks like when it's fully engaged. So this drug that we found, this one that's commonly used, a PPAR agonist called rosiglitazone, is very good at inhibiting MUC1 expression. This is just looking at the protein in a couple of different cell lines. And so progesterone treated, add rosiglitazone's knocked down, add rosiglitazone protein's down too. This is the statistics on it. It turns out that members of the EGF family also stimulate MUC1 expression, and there's an interesting story for these growth factors in uterine biology. And so both HBEGF and EGF stimulate MUC1 expression, and rosiglitazone also reduces expression in those contexts. Peng Wang, when he was a grad student in the lab, figured out how PPAR gamma attenuated progesterone responsiveness, and it enhances the degradation of liganded progesterone receptor. And that's a complicated story, but suffice it to say this. I don't know how to relate that exactly to this response. One of the things we know is that it also enhances degradation of liganded EGF receptor. The mechanism we still have to work out, we don't know how it does that. So these PPAR gamma agonists also inhibit cytokine driven MUC1 expression. So every context that we can stimulate MUC1 expression, these drugs seem to be able to inhibit it. And so we think it might be a useful way of doing this. I'm just going to wind up by saying a few things about MUC1 and tumor biology. And I mentioned some of this already. It's very highly expressed or overexpressed in cancer cells. Some of it may be by just activating the expression, and some of it is through gene duplication. Cancer cells typically lose polarity. MUC1 is no longer restricted to the apical cell surface. It's all over the surface. Some of it even gets intracellularly, where it may participate in these signal transduction processes. And I said before, it protects cancer cells from cytotoxic drug killing and apoptosis. So here's the model. Normal cells, normal epithelial cells, restrict MUC1 and other mucins to the apical surface. Upon loss of polarity, a couple of things happen. There's overexpression of MUC1. It gets glycosylated differently, so now there are antibodies that recognize tumor forms of MUC1 that don't recognize the normal forms, and those are used for various clinical markers. And when the tumor cells express MUC1, they lose adherence to the basal lamina and to each other, and that promotes metastasis. It causes them to be released from that site. And it protects them once they're released, too. So it creates a microenvironment around them, whether they're in the bloodstream or whether they're just in tissue. And it's really kind of a nasty molecule. So I should have a UR here written somewhere on there, right? So the only thing you need to take away from this is all the intracellular signal transduction processes that's actually not all of them, but it's a large number of them that MUC1 participates in, the cytoplasmic tail of MUC1 participates in. So the ectodomain, large and very problematic, is only part of the story. These interactions have all been shown in tumor cells. Whether they occur in normal cells, we're trying to figure out, but it's believed to be a real problem in tumor cells. So what we've been trying to do, in addition to trying to drug it, is to take advantage of the availability of a lot of antibodies that are available that are directed specifically to MUC1. MUC1 is a great target. It's a great target for nanoparticles, and this is drawn to scale. So we're working with folks at Rice University, some physicists and chemical engineers, to make various sorts of nanoparticles and nanoshells, conjugating them to MUC1 antibodies to target MUC1 expressing cells. You can get multiple nanoparticles attached to MUC1 as opposed to conventional cell surface receptors. So they make really good targets, and you can bind these things to them. And you can. I'll show some data that we've started to develop using plasmonic nanobubbles to actually destroy the cells, and they can also be used to deliver chemotherapeutic drugs or siRNA. So this is just a micrograph showing a mixture of uterine cells. This is a HeST cell line and a human fibroblastic cell line here in green. The red dots are where the nanoparticles, the MUC1-directed nanoparticles have bound. So they bound very robustly to the MUC1-expressing cells and not to the non-expressing cells. And you can take prostate cancer cells that don't express MUC1, and you can do the reverse, and you can target them with prostate-specific antigen antibodies, and they'll bind to the prostate cancer cells but not the uterine cells. So you really can get great specificity. If you incubate these nanoparticles, you'll see these little black dots that stick to the cell surface at 4 degrees, warm them up, they get endocytosed, they get inside the cells. Once they're inside the cells, you can take advantage of some of the optical properties of nanoparticles to pulse them with very short pulses, half a nanosecond pulse of a very low energy laser, and depending on how long and the energy of the laser, it will excite through surface plasmon resonance the surface of these nanoparticles. It works better in clusters. There's a very, very localized heating process that takes place. The heating doesn't kill the cells. What the heating does is forms a bubble around these particles. So if you do it for a short period of time, you can see the bubble and you can see cells that have taken up the nanoparticle. If you zap them for a little bit longer period of time, you know, then the bubble, or with a little bit larger energy, the bubble gets larger and it blows up the cell by physically disrupting the membrane. So showing an example, if you throw nanoparticles on cells and you don't zap them with a laser, and this is just showing that you an area that's been scanned with a laser, if there's no laser and no nanoparticles, the cells are fine and intact. If you give them a low energy pulse or a very short, even very short pulse of the laser, it will damage. This is trypan blue uptake, so it'll damage the cells, but it doesn't, so it's damaging them immediately. And if you a little bit longer pulse, it'll just blow them up and destroy them. So the applications to this, to things like cancer, I think, you know, are obvious. It provides an opportunity for folks to do some microsurgery in a very focused or diffuse tumors, and that's what the docs seem to be interested in their cases of that. We hope we can use it for diffuse cases of endometriosis as well, where mucins are expressed. And I also have the wild idea that maybe we could use it to locally eliminate some uterine epithelium right at a site and then drop an embryo on it and see if the embryo would implant there once the barrier of the uterine epithelium has been removed. So we're trying to do this in some animal models to see if we can get all that stuff to work. I'll skip over this. The other thing is MUC1 is just one of several mucins that are expressed in the of these types of glycoproteins that are expressed in the uterus. So here's MUC1. You remember I showed you the cartoon about how huge it was compared to all those other cell surface components. So other major membrane-tethered mucins that are in the uterus are MUC4 and MUC16. So MUC1 is the baby of the family. MUC4 is really much bigger than MUC1, and MUC16 or CA125 is another commonly used name for it, is absolutely huge. So when I say these things are huge and dominate cell surfaces, I really meant it. So this is just some data taken just from some other lab citation here, just showing MUC4 doesn't seem to be expressed very much in the human uterus. We're trying to confirm this ourselves, but does arise during cancer development. And Eileen Gibson showed some years ago in a very reputable journal that MUC16 is expressed in the human uterine epithelium throughout the cycle. So we need to get busy looking at these as well. And one of the things that we want to understand, a few things, we want to know how MUC4 and MUC16 are regulated in various contexts. Are they regulated the same as MUC1 or differently? Because if we found drugs to reduce MUC1, but they only elevated these other mucins, we wouldn't get anywhere. So that's a question. So that's another way of asking it. We would like to, ideally, we're hoping that we can use these PPAR agonists to drug MUC4 and MUC16. And so in combination with cytokine regulation, which we might be able to promote mucin expression, that would be a plus, because maybe in cases of people that were at risk for infection, you might want to do that of the vaginal tract or other tissues. You might want to elevate MUC1 expression to protect them, and you might want to reduce it under other conditions, say to improve IVF embryo transfer success. And of course, once we work out things for MUC1 targeting with nanotherapies, we would like to see if MUC4 and MUC16 are also good candidates. These are it's Texas, right? So you know, we got to have a Texas thing. This was done at the livestock show. So this is Nirja Dharmaraj, who did a lot of promoter bashing in the lab and still there. Brian Engel, who's looking at MUC1 signaling. Brian Danish, who is working on nanoparticles and targeting, and Pam Constantino, who's a chemical engineer associated with the group that actually makes the nanoparticles and makes us all look better. And I need to thank Dmitry Lopatko, who's the physicist that works with us and knows things about plasmon resonance and optics that we don't. So with that, I'll thank you for your patience.
McGill University. I really enjoy your talk, by the way. This was really interesting, and I have questions regarding possibility in the human population having problem for the implantation. And are you aware that it could be some of the causes why people can't get pregnant, or that's why people go to ARTs, or even why some cases ART doesn't work? And can we find an easy way to detect those women that have problems in removing those muck from the wall,
right? I won't say the obvious joke, but anyway, so the short answer is we don't know, because to really be sure, I mean, since MUC1's actually elevated in humans during the period, you'd almost have to see if there are women who can't get rid of it locally at an embryo implantation site, and we can't do the experiments. So that's possible. People have looked carefully to see if there were differences in MUC1 expression, or that there are different isoforms of MUC. We all have two alleles of MUC1, and that, okay, of course we all have two alleles. Well, maybe not all of you. Some might have three. So it's but there's two, but they're actually different. In almost everybody, they'll be different. One's larger than the others. There's allelic polymorphism, and the reason they're different is it's always because of differences in the tandem repeat region. One of the alleles will have more tandem repeats than the others. As it turns out, one of the biochemical or cell biological studies that have been done with mucins is to ask, how short can the mucin be to function as a barrier? And that number has been determined, actually, for MUC1 and MUC4. The shortest allele you ever see in humans corresponds exactly to how short it can be to function as a barrier. So people have looked at the differences in the allelic polymorphism between fertile and infertile women. They've looked at all that, and there's no correlation. So that's why I said the short answer is no, but the longer answer is, it would be nice if we had a good model system where we could test that. For example, if they need to use shed aces to get rid of them, it could be that women have defects in activating the shed aces to locally clear MUC1 and get it there. So it's really important question, and we need to be more clever in figuring that out.
Could it be possible just to go and collect a piece of the uterine wall and try to see if at least those muck are responsive to PARP gamma agonist or something? So that would tell you, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in data mining is to look for women that are actually on PPAR agonists. The commercial name is Avandia, and if they're receiving Avandia, or when they go into IVF, they have improved fertility. And that data is probably there, but it hasn't been looked at. So, it turns out, though, that a lot of women that are on it will often be obese, and they already have fertility problems. So it's complicated.
Thank you.
Chris Price at University of Montreal. You mentioned the MUC1 null mouse.
Uh-huh.
Is that a targeted disruption or a whole animal?
It was just done at the whole animal level. It wasn't tissue specific, and the animal kept in a barrier facility has no obvious phenotype. If you bring the animal out of the barrier facility, just put in a normal animal. A normal mouse facility, it starts to develop infections and irritations and various. It gets mastitis. It develops eye infections. It gets reproductive tract infections and so on, which kind of makes sense given the normal role of it. But the mice are perfectly fertile. So there's no implantation defect there. So again, you have to get rid of MUC1 to support implantation. So the fact that they might be normally fertile seemed okay. So what we did is we thought, let's transfer attachment-competent blastocysts early, you know, precociously, you know, so there's no barrier there. Normally an embryo would only implant on day 4.5 to 5 in mice. So maybe if they have no MUC1, if we added a blastocyst at day 1 or day 2, they might implant. But in fact, they don't. So as much as I'd like to say the world revolves around MUC1, apparently there's more to it than that. Those are the experiments we've done to address the fertility. So that's why I tried to say I think loss of MUC1 is necessary, but certainly not sufficient. You have to have the receptors there for the embryo to bind to, and they just don't seem to be there. Does that get it?
Yeah, I guess the secondary question was, I'd be curious, I mean, what happens to the gastrointestinal mucosa?
Yeah, so in the GI tract, it turns out that there are other mucins that are expressed there. And, in fact, MUC1 only comes up in tumors in those cells. These other mucins that I mentioned seem to be dominant in those cases. Bernard?
It's remarkable how you can make MUCs interesting.
Tell my students that.
I was thinking of the opposite. If you have a Nova expressor, transgenic, are you going to be transgenic mouse? Are you going to affect the fertility? I wouldn't have thought that the knockout would affect fertility, but the transgenic might.
Yeah. So we thought about how we would do that because you don't want to just put it on a strong constitutive promoter because you'd have it in all these different cells and you can force expression in a fibroblast. So what happens with MUC1 expressing, high expressing cells? They don't attach to tissue culture dishes. It's actually very difficult to culture. You have to trap tumor cells that do this. So I don't think anyone's tried to make a real super expressor. So so we thought about there is a way that's a very elaborate way that we could conditionally express MUC1 in the uterine epithelium. But we have to make these mice so that we can create strains that are fertile and then cross them in a way so that we can selectively make them infertile. And there is a way to do it, but there's a lot of breeding to do. And NIH never forced me to do it. I did try to force a graduate student to do it, but then she did other things and graduated. But it's a very good experiment. It would be nice to prove that, but you really have to be careful how you do it because if you just make infertile mice, then you can't really do the experiments you want to do.
I guess the other aspect of the mice story is if you knock out MUC1, do you affect MUC4 and MUC16?
That's never been looked at. I mean, we're going to look at that. I mean, I'm very interested in, we're also interested in what it turns out that MUC1 and MUC4 both complex with EGF receptors and control their expression in sort of some interesting way. So we're interested in that as well.
Rima Slim, what about the litter size in the knockout mice?
It's the same.
Same, exactly.
Yeah. That's they're perfectly happy.
Not hyper fertile.
Nope. No. We were very disappointed.
Mm. Okay. One last question.
I was wondering. I know the main role is a barrier, but being a mucin, and when you say at the mid luteal phase you have this keratin sulfate, could also be a reservoir for growth factors. Could it trap growth factors like some proteoglycans have been shown, at the surface, and then it could affect the endometrium development in that way?
Yeah. Keratin sulfate is a very, very poor binder of growth factors. Heparin and heparin sulfate are really good at it. There is one growth factor. I think a certain form of colony stimulating factor will actually bind to chondroitin sulfate. We use keratin sulfate as a negative control for. We actually did a lot of stuff with heparin and heparin sulfate, and the growth factors are sort of interesting. There's interaction because they read certain structures. It's the way that you assemble heparin and heparin sulfate is a very ordered series, and it has sequence information. But that's another story and very glyco-geeky.
Okay, well, thank you for a really interesting talk.